Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case. Today's subject is technology. We generally think of it as a positive force in our lives. We expect technology to keep getting better, and at least recently it seems that those hopes are being borne out. But is there a fly in this ointment? Is there anything to be afraid of? So the subject for today is the dark side of technology, or potential dark sides of technology. And here to discuss that topic with me is my friend Ryan Jenkins. Ryan is an associate professor at Cal Poly. Is it Cal Poly San Luis Obispo? Is that the full name?
Yep.
Great. Well, it's good to have you here.
Yeah. Thanks, Spencer. Good to be here.
So I know that you did your dissertation work here at Colorado with me on metaethics and quite abstract topics, and then you shifted to philosophy of technology or ethics of technology, and I'm interested in hearing about what your motivation for that was and what interested you in that topic.
Well, for a long time, I've always been interested in ethics, so that was my main area of interest ever since I was an undergraduate, and I'd had an interest in the ethics of warfare in particular, because I found warfare a fascinating human enterprise and a kind of dark permanent feature of the international landscape, despite the better angels of our nature. And so I wrote some papers on the ethics of war when I was an undergraduate. And when I was here, there was a special issue of the Journal of Military Ethics on cyber warfare. And I had taken a little bit of an interest in cyber warfare, at least as much as following current events. And I threw my hat in the ring, and my abstract got selected to be built out into a full paper for that special issue of that journal. And that jump-started my interest in technology ethics as well, because at least in the non-academic world, I think we often have this view, and sometimes in the academic world, we have a view that new technological change causes us to revisit the old ethical frameworks that we've been using for hundreds or thousands of years, and can cause us to rethink our assumptions and revisit things that we've taken for granted. And that's not always true. And in fact, it's often very encouraging that the frameworks and approaches that we've used for millennia can still help us understand and grapple with technological change. There's an argument that philosophy of technology, rather than some niche upstart, is actually one of the oldest areas of technology, because we find Plato making a lot of contributions to this area.
One of the oldest areas of philosophy.
Yeah, what did I say?
Technology.
Yeah, one of the oldest areas of philosophy, because we find Plato telling us some things about technology that are still salient. And in my philosophy of technology classes, we read a couple excerpts from Plato because we still have things to learn.
So how would you define technology then?
That's tough. Just like defining any generic concept in philosophy is going to be tough. And if you ask a dozen people, they'll give you a dozen definitions.
Anyone who's had sat down in a class about Plato and tried to do a conceptual analysis of any ordinary language term knows what a trick that is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Technology in the broad scheme of things is techniques and methods and processes that are rationally organized to try to accomplish a goal. So notice that includes things that are not just artifacts, because when I ask a classroom full of students, list some technologies, they say, oh, the phone in my pocket, or the zipper on my backpack. But there are other technologies that we have too, like bureaucracy or democracy or potentially something like mathematics.
What about written language?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is one of the places where Plato chimes in about the introduction of new technologies and how they might change our understanding of the world and our interactions with each other. He talks about the written word.
Huh, that's interesting. I would want to say, like, maybe spoken language wouldn't be a technology because it's too intrinsic to who we are and not an extension of who we are using the material world.
Yeah, that's right. Although there are technologies that are immaterial. There are technologies that are merely processes or approaches. You know, what's interesting is that spoken language seems like a boundary case to me. I'm not sure if I feel strongly one way or the other, but something like grammar seems like a technology, and it's a regimented, rational set of concepts and tools for understanding and parsing spoken language, in the same way that the scientific method might be a set of tools for understanding the natural world.
So conceivably, like a new meditation technique could be a new technology.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, I want to throw this this sort of thought at you. And there's this particular picture that I think a lot of people assume, and even when we're not assuming, it seems like a plausible picture. And I'm just going to call it, you know, the optimistic picture of technology, and which is just that, look, technology keeps getting better. And when technology gets better, the world gets better. We should just embrace technological change as much as we can, because it seems like it's a good thing. And people who are afraid of new technologies often look like fuddy-duddies when a little bit of time goes by, right? And so in order to like sort of steel man this optimistic picture I'm describing, I want to point out a couple of salient facts that I've learned, right? So I listened to this audiobook series from The Great Courses called The Other Side of History, and it's about what life was like for the ordinary person in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, in the medieval times. And it is astonishing to realize what people suffered back then. So astonishing that it really seems like a miracle that humans managed to reproduce and keep the species going this long rather than just giving up in despair. Certainly, if we were reduced to the position of somebody in ancient Greece, the average American today might just feel despairing about it and give up. So the average woman had to give birth to several children just to keep the population at a steady level. She could count on having, you know, you'd be incredibly blessed if none of your kids died. Giving birth was incredibly risky. There was a quote from an ancient play, I forget which one, or maybe it's just a fragment of a play that survived, where a female character says, "I'd rather go into battle three times than to give birth once." And you can project this forward for centuries, right? Like, people would die over the most trivial things. Like, within the 20th century, Calvin Coolidge's son was playing tennis and got a blister and it got infected. He died a few years before penicillin became widely available. And all sorts of other things I could point to, but I think I've made the case. So it looks like a lot of this is due to technological progress. There's been some social progress as well, of course. But it seems like a lot of, like, certainly the medical technology is attributable to technological advancements, and that's why we live longer, live healthier, happier lives. So what is it that then that mitigates against a completely optimistic view of technology? We can just expect things to keep getting better. What do you have to say about that?
I think the reason why this view is so popular is that there's a lot of good evidence for it. And even a glancing acquaintance with the history of humanity would give you a lot of evidence to think that things have gotten markedly better. And they have, to be clear. This is a plausible view. But I think what's risky is the unalloyed optimism that this view can slide into. Because even when advances take place, there's often, as you put it, there's often another side to these advances. And there's often something that they bring about with them that's problematic at the same time. So one example I'm thinking of comes from Neil Postman. And speaking of medical advances, he tells a story in Technopoly, or he gives us a history in Technopoly of the stethoscope. And he says the stethoscope is a great medical advancement. I don't know if you remember this example.
I don't.
But the stethoscope, I'm not sure when it was invented. I'm going to guess late 1800s or early 1900s. And it was one of the first technologies that was widely available, perhaps the first medical technology that was widely available, I'm going to guess that it predated the X-ray, that gave doctors the ability to see inside the body of a living person. It gave doctors the ability to detect something inside the body of a living person. And when it did this, it encouraged a certain relationship between doctor and patient. And the relationship was one where the doctor was the expert and suddenly knew better than the patient did about the patient's own body.
Wait, didn't doctors always have this view? Didn't they always consider themselves experts?
Well, I suspect that they always considered themselves experts, and they were experts in virtue of their greater training and experience. But I think Postman's point is that it gave them a new justification to discount the testimony of their patients. I think that's the worry. So with this new technology comes a new kind of special power or ability that's accorded to one sector of society, and the consequence is that certain relationships that we had taken for granted now shift, and oftentimes they shift for the worse. because even today, doctor-patient relationships are something that are challenging and frustrating for a lot of people. And we often feel, I imagine one of the greatest frustrations that we have with doctors is that we don't really feel like they're listening to us when we go in.
That's interesting. You know, that wasn't the example from Neil Postman I thought you were going to use. I thought you were going to use the example of the Luddites.
There are a lot of there are a lot of good examples from Neil Postman.
Yeah, could you fill me in on the Luddites? I think you probably are more familiar with that example than I am.
So there's a great story of about the Luddites, or a great point about the Luddites that comes from Langdon Winner. I'm not sure if it's I don't remember what Postman says about them, but Luddites were a labor resistance movement that sprung up in 1700s England, I think the first half of the 1700s in England. And it was a group of people who were weavers, and they were frustrated, the story goes, by new sophisticated weaving machines that were putting them out of work. And so they rebelled against their masters by going on a rampage and destroying a lot of these looms that were going to put them out of work. And people use this as an example of technological unemployment, the phenomenon of people being made unemployed by new technologies or robots displacing workers in factories and so on. And Langdon Winner says, the Luddites have gotten a really bad rap.
It's a term of abuse now, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, a Luddite is someone who's has a sort of unthinking opposition to technology because it's new. And Langdon Winner says, the Luddites asked two questions. When they were confronted with this challenge of the new machinery being introduced, the Luddites asked two questions. They said, does it make the end product better? And does it make the process of making it more enjoyable? And if the answer to both of those questions is no, then the introduction of the machine, the new machine, should be resisted. And when you ask that kind of question, it doesn't sound outrageous, because those are still frustrations that a lot of us feel in the workplace. If management or someone introduces a new technology or a new process, and we see it as more busy work that makes our job harder and more frustrating, and it has no obvious payoff in the end product, we quite reasonably ask ourselves, what's the advantage of this technology? Are we doing it just because it's new? And the lesson from that story from Winner is the Luddites were not crazy people. They were keenly aware of the changes that new technologies made in their lives.
Did you mention that the Luddites not only opposed the new technology, but actually famously tried to destroy some of it?
Yeah, they did. As far as I know, they did destroy some of it violently, and I'm not sure if people might have died as a result. So I'm not advocating a whole cloth adoption of their strategy.
Sure. Well, their view does also seem incomplete, because it made their work worse, didn't make the product better, but it made it a lot cheaper, and that was to the benefit of many working class people, just not them.
That's exactly right, yeah, and it's primarily, I imagine a cynic would say, and probably Winner himself would say, I'm quite confident, that the reason it was ultimately introduced even over and above their protests was that it made management wealthier, it made management's job easier, and the advantages of the new technology, as is often the case even today, accrued to capital rather than labor. So you could view it through that lens as well. Marx's philosophy of technology is also tremendously influential, and we see a lot of these same discussions coming up in the conflict of capital and labor, and how those conflicts can be viewed through a technological lens.
So I was thinking that this qualifies the optimism in at least one way that we would also have to say about capitalism. I'm pretty pro-capitalist, but I think that this point needs to be acknowledged, that capitalism involves creative destruction, and overall, I think that's tremendous. I think it's good. But it's not good for everyone always. Like, somebody pays a cost. The destruction comes at a real human cost, right? Now, if your job is like liquidated, and you know your entire field is made irrelevant by technology. I don't know. You're a candle maker, and it's time for light bulbs to take over, and you're out of business. Now, that might be great for society. It's not great for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's at least one thing that's true of technology generally, is technological advances, even when they're for the clear good of society, are not to the clear good of everyone in society.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It bears repeating. And it's one of the jobs, I think, of maybe not technologists themselves. They would probably resist the suggestion that they have this obligation. But it's the obligation perhaps of the government or other forces in society to be really keenly aware of how technological changes percolate through society and the social implications that they have. and the way that their benefits and harms are distributed unequally.
Now, there's another reason I want to qualify the optimistic picture that is more unsettling to me, because it's skepticism about the view that it's true that we can accurately look back and say, yes, overall technology has been great for humans up till now, but I'm not sure how much license we have to project that forward, because it seems like we're constantly in radically new territory, right? We're constantly in radically new territory. It just seems like, okay, suppose we say, okay, the Industrial Revolution worked out well, the printing press worked out well, written language worked out well, therefore artificial intelligence is going to work out well.
Right.
We can't do that, right? Like, we just are in uncharted territory, and if technology continues to advance, then it seems like we're always in uncharted territory, and it's unclear to me how much we can generalize based on our experience.
Yeah. I think that it might be difficult to appraise artificial intelligence as an innovation itself, because that's difficult, because it's already being applied in so many different sectors and for so many different reasons and by different parties for different motivations and so on, and its effects are being felt in a lot of different ways. So it would be a real challenge to say artificial intelligence thumbs up or thumbs down. And when I tell people sometimes, if I'm like sitting next to someone on a plane and I tell them I study technology, and they say, "So do you like technology?" As if there's just a yes
no.
Or no
I
answer.
Want this to fall out of the sky right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping against hope that. And I would say the same thing about artificial intelligence, that it's difficult to say yes or no. I think we have reasons to be wary of it in certain contexts more than others. But I do see your point. There's a widely shared feeling that the pace of technological change is accelerating. I don't know if there's evidence for that. I'm not sure what evidence for that would look like. You know, the number of patents being filed, or the speed of microprocessors, the rate at which they're increasing, or something like that. I'm not really sure how you would measure that. And so I'm not sure if that view is actually correct. But there is certainly, and I think for some decades now, there's a widespread feeling that the technological system that we inhabit is getting more and more complicated, and it's being submerged more and more beyond the understanding of any particular person. And I find it kind of funny when I go back and read things from the 40s or 50s, because the feeling goes back to them. And there's one piece that we read in one of my classes that talks about this feeling of anomie, lawlessness, or being lost in the existential sense in confrontation with, quote, the machine. And I think machine's in quotes, and it's capitalized. And this is a piece from like 1958 or something. So clearly this view's been around for some time. But I definitely think that there's a real worry there.
How about this as a potential way, like a sort of rough and ready way for measuring the rate of change technologically? If you were born as, say, a peasant in ancient China, say 300 BC, think about what you would expect for your grandchildren, for your great-grandchildren, and like, you probably aren't expecting any major differences in the way humans organize themselves, right? Whereas, try to think of what life might be like on Earth in 2100. Will the nation state exist? Will humans have like uploaded themselves to the computers, and the human race will have, you know, been replaced by something else? I mean, that's out there. But like, I'm just saying, there's like a huge range of possibilities that go beyond the mundane that, you know, maybe a couple of centuries in the past, people might have imagined flight and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the unknowns are much greater for us now than they used to be, as far as this stuff is concerned.
That does seem really plausible. If you imagine the kinds of, say, tools and knowledge that your children or your children's children would have had access to a couple of thousand years ago, it's easy to think that human history was relatively stagnant in terms of technological innovation, in terms of the social structures that were in place, and that we definitely can't say that for the next 100 years. It's difficult or impossible to imagine what life will be like for our children's children, and it's also roughly equally plausible that it could go either way. It could be catastrophic, or it could be utopian, and lots of people would argue for either one. Now, that does seem really plausible. It does seem in that sense that technology is changing faster than it did in the past.
Well, this just, I hadn't thought about this before, but you've made me think of this, that maybe one of the downsides of technology or rapid technological change just is uncertainty, feeling a lot of anxiety about what kind of structures, what kind of existence humans will have a generation from now, 10 years from now, obviously greater with more time. But it seems like the more rapidly technology changes and advances, the less certainty we have. And that causes a kind of, there's a kind of mental cost to that, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I think the question is whether that mental cost is so significant that it swamps, the mere cost of uncertainty or doubt is so significant that it swamps the benefits that we get. Lots of things that we do in life come with uncertainty, but I definitely think that it's a real concern, and people are apt to, people are wont to brush it aside. They want to say, well, you're right. We haven't figured out everything. We haven't figured out all the consequences of autonomous vehicles, but look, there are lots of reasons why we're really confident that their consequences will be net positive. And a lot of people in my experience are satisfied to leave the conversation there.
So maybe we should talk about specific technologies that have already been created that have had substantially bad consequences. Maybe not overall, but substantially bad consequences. Do you have any examples of that come to mind?
I think the automobile is a decent example of that. The automobile surely has lots of positive benefits, but ironically, one of its benefits was thought to be an improvement to the environmental conditions in America's cities, or in the world's cities, because if you go back to the turn of the century and the main mode of transportation is horse-drawn carriage or something like that, then you'll find that the streets are just littered with manure all the time. So people thought that a car that had no visible exhaust was a fantastic improvement. And it was for 100 years or so. But now we've seen that it's come with some other environmental consequences that we don't welcome with such open arms.
And even more so when they had leaded gas.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So those are some of the consequences that come from the unforeseen negative effects of technologies. But even on the more mundane, the more quotidian scale, there are reasons why cars are a mixed benefit at best. Lots of people like driving in their cars, but cars are also a very stressful way to drive, depending on how you, where you're driving and what kind of traffic you have. It's an incredible source of stress and anxiety. Until recently, it was a huge source of accidents and loss of life. It's just astonishing if you look back in the early days of automobiles to see how many people would have died in car accidents even up until the 70s, before those rates have started to drop precipitously. And then the effect of the car on the city has been quite remarkable too. It's really dispersed and diffused the activities that used to take place in a city center, and that's had a lot of social consequences that are pretty worrisome. Not only has it led us to pave over more and more of nature, something like 40% of the land in Los Angeles is dedicated to cars, either through roads or parking lots. When you think about it that way, it's pretty fantastic. But the consequences in terms of our social interactions when the car enabled the flight to the suburbs after the war and things like that, there are a lot of people that suggest that the car enabled drastic changes to the way that we organized our cities that have had serious negative effects.
Yeah, and the thought that the automobile, together with other transportation technologies, make people more mobile, of course, but this is a blessing and a curse, at least a mixed blessing, right?
Right.
Because when people are more mobile, they tend to not interact with the same people as much. There might be this feeling of rootedness. People move a lot more than they used to, and that makes it difficult to establish long-term friendships and relationships with other people.
That's right. I think in Technopoly, Postman calls the airplane, I don't know if he says the same thing about the car, but he calls the airplane a weapon of mass destruction against the family. And I have felt that acutely just recently because my wife and I just had a baby, and we live in California, and all of our parents live in Florida. And on the one hand, you think, well, it's great that the airplane enables us to live on opposite sides of the country. And if need be, my parents are 6 or 8 hours away by plane flight. But on the other hand, it means that they get to see their grandchild twice a year. And that's something that would have been very unusual even a couple generations ago. And especially going back to ancient human history or very early human history, when the anthropological evidence suggests that we settled down in family units and tribes. And believe me, my wife and I can appreciate that mode of living now and the kind of assistance that it would have afforded, the assistance that we don't have access to now.
Yeah, so I'm thinking now that when we imagine a lot of possible horrible futures enabled by technology, I mean, there's this whole genre of literature called dystopian literature. We should talk about that in a moment. But the point I wanted to make was typically it's radically authoritarian and centralized and stuff like 1984 and Brave New World. Everything is controlled. And that is one of the things to be afraid of. But it seems like the dystopia of excessive autonomy, where people have too many choices and don't know what to do with their freedom, and that seems like that's one of the negative possibilities we've got to consider. And it's sort of more insidious because we're sort of instinctively afraid of strong, central, powerful governments that watch us all the time in this kind of stuff. But we're less afraid of having too many choices for ourselves. Why would we be afraid of that, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and one of the reasons why technology is praised is that it democratizes freedom. It gives people options to do things that they didn't have before, or it makes things easier for them to do that were more difficult before. So we don't spend a lot of time thinking about what might be wrong with having too much freedom, or on a similar note, what might be wrong with having access to machinery or devices that cater to your every desire. That's one way of putting it. I'm more free because anything I would hope to accomplish, I have access to a machine that will help me accomplish or do for me. And I think that Brave New World gets us kind of close to that. Brave New World is a story of people having too many of their desires fulfilled. It's a world where that life has become stultified because technology is so advanced. And what people choose is to be entertained and distracted all of the time, amused, right? In the title of Postman's book that you and I both admire quite a bit. I think that there's another example that might be one that you wanted to broach, which is The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And that's again, a fantastic, fantastic short story. And what we're given is a surprisingly prescient picture. The story was written in like 1912, I think, or 1909, something like that. We have a story of people who basically live in smart homes that have access to something like the internet and video chat. And they sort of fritter away their days reading pieces of trivia or watching very short video, like video lectures, which I imagine are something like TED Talks. And they seem to judge their fulfillment, or they judge the success of the time that they've spent by how many quote-unquote ideas they get. Do you remember this from the book?
I don't.
They'll say, oh, I watched the new lecture by so-and-so. I didn't enjoy it very much. It didn't give me many ideas. And that's like the only way that they can evaluate whether they're spending their time well or whether they're being productive. And I think that there's a sort of tongue-in-cheek reference there to people whose cognitive and physical faculties have atrophied so much that they don't actually do anything. They just sit in chairs and sit in houses that do everything for them. And all they do is think about trivia all day long. And this is a life, like in a lot of these dystopias where the world has become very smooth and convenient, it's a life that we're not meant to admire.
Yeah, there are a couple of different worries raised in that short story. One of them is similar to the worry brought up by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, and it's got something to do with the effect of this kind of freedom on our moral characters and the lack of meaning in our lives when there's nothing really to struggle against because technology has made it all too easy for us. And then there's this other worry that I think you can motivate quite independently that you find in The Machine Stops, which I guess this isn't much of a giveaway given the title, right? Which is that when the machine stops, humans are completely helpless, right? We become too dependent on technology. So it suggests that there are two sort of, I guess they're compatible, but they seem opposite sorts of worries. So the one, technology failing, and then technology doing its job all too well. And these are each threats to us.
Yeah. The one that that technology creates a kind of dependency, I think that worry strikes me as a little less interesting because I think it's very easy to grasp. And we've all been in situations where our car wouldn't start or something like that. And that wakes us up to how dependent we are on our technology and oftentimes at the same time, how little we understand it. I mean, I had a, you know, my toilet at home was running like 2 weeks ago and I had to take the thing apart and fix it. And my first three or four attempts failed and seemed to make the problem worse. And that really showed me how little I understand about the most basic devices that we've taken for granted for 100 years.
Apparently there's a study where they asked a bunch of people, how does a zipper work? And they think they know, and then they try to explain it, and they don't know.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Maybe it's the same study, but someone told me about a study where they asked people to draw the physical workings of different devices, like a toilet. I mean, a toilet, I have no idea. I could not even hazard a guess. I've seen the inside of a toilet 100 times, but I couldn't draw. I can't tell you how the parts interact. But the one that really gets me is they asked them to draw a bicycle, and people could not draw a bicycle. And, you know, half the things they drew wouldn't even go if you turned the pedals, that sort of thing. So that's one worry, that we're very dependent on our technologies, and certainly that's true, and that's worrisome in case that they fail. The other worry is a more interesting to me because it's so challenging to put concretely. And when I stand in front of a room of students or when I converse with my colleagues and I ask them in a very sincere way, do you think there could be anything wrong with living a life that was too easy, supposing our machines never failed us? So it's not, you try to bracket off the worry about dependency and you say, could there be something wrong with living in a world where our machines just made our lives very easy? That is very hard to put a fine point on. But the resources for answering that question, I think, have to come from virtue ethics. They have to come from the theory that says we are what we habitually do, or we become what we habitually do. And if we never struggle, if we're never frustrated or asked to exercise patience, then we turn into the kind of people who are superficial and who have very little moral character to speak of. And then you have to appeal to someone's intuition that it would be bad to be that kind of person.
Now, I want to ask you, though, if that's the case, couldn't somebody say that about us right now? In fact, I think wouldn't Nietzsche want to say this about us right now? From the perspective of somebody who lived 300 BC, like, wow, like, look at this Brave New World kind of society where people didn't have to live through their kids dying a bunch of times before they could have a kid that would live to adulthood.
Right.
I would want to say that they're mistaken about that, right? Like, the world really is better where people don't have to live through their kids dying and we're not constantly at war with one another. So I wonder if I want to say that it's an illusion for them to think that we are sort of enfeebled and weakened and therefore all things considered worse off now. Couldn't that same critique of the critique of the critique of utopia be run against our perspective?
Yeah, I think it could. And I think that there are two important things to say. One is to clarify, I think it's a really tough sell to say that we are all things considered worse off now than we were 100 years ago or however long ago. That's, I find, pretty implausible. As much as I am concerned about technology, I find that pretty implausible. The other one is a critique that capitalizes on some research in psychology about what's called the hedonic treadmill that says if people reach a certain level of happiness, you'll find that they get used to it. And they're always searching at the next thing, the next improvement in their condition. There's a good line from Epictetus, I think, who says, when you're practicing gratitude, you should remind yourself that the things that you have now were once among the things that you only dreamed of having. So we aspire after something and then we obtain it and then we think that we'll be happy forever because we've gotten it, and we find that our level of happiness subsides to about where it was before. And so we're always looking for something else to make us happy. I think that there's a similar point that you could make about this concern, which is that, yes, technology will continue to make our lives easier, but we'll always find new frustrations or new things that will demand of us that we exercise and practice our patience, for example, or the kinds of virtues that are called upon in those situations. And I think that's pretty plausible. So I'm sort of on the fence about this worry in general.
When I was in Afghanistan, I so wanted that deployment to be over and to be back studying philosophy at CU Boulder. I thought, once I'm back as a graduate student in philosophy in a country where no one's trying to kill me and I don't have officers and that sort of thing telling me to do things, I'll just never be unhappy again. What could I possibly be unhappy right. about? And that didn't last very long.
Yeah, that's a pretty stark. It'd be hard to imagine a more stark contrast, right, between being in a war zone and coming back to beautiful, sunny Boulder, Colorado, the happiest city in America, you know, sitting in repose and thinking deep thoughts in an air-conditioned office. And if that change in situation still faded away and you got used to that, then that's pretty indicative, I think.
It just it took like 5 minutes of like my internet not working or something. I don't know. I don't remember. But that sort of thing. Still, though, I mean, about this Brave New World thing, if you think it's really, really implausible that we're worse off than we were a few hundred years ago, somebody could say, well, look, we don't have cancer, right? We don't have poverty. All of that seems really, really positive. Maybe it's worth some cost to our virtue. Maybe the world Huxley describes really is all things considered better off than ours. And yet it still seems, even if, my intuition is, even if you grant that, there's still something really unsettling about it.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone seems phenomenally happy all the time, even though they also seem like simpletons.
Yeah.
And so again, their lives are not enviable when we look at them and see the things that they're concerned about and what makes them happy or sad. And we think that they're basically just children running around. I think that's right. And it's because there's something to be said for deeper pursuits that demand struggle and necessarily engender frustration. And a life with frustration and triumph is greater than a life of no struggle but constant happiness.
Yeah, that is interesting. Now, I did want to say something about the less interesting concern that just like our machines will break. Okay, it might be less interesting, but we should really be worried about that. And it seems to me like we have had enough things happen recently that we should definitely have this on the forefront of our minds. Like, what a massive technological strike from a foreign government could do. Or what a major solar flare could do, or an EMP attack, you know, which the enemy launches a nuclear bomb and blows it up in the sky, and the electronic pulse takes out all of our electronics. I mean, that would kill most of us. And it seems like we really ought to be putting a lot more attention into protecting these things from failing. And it's weirdly just not something that seems to ever be brought out in front of political consciousness, right? Like, I would have thought after Russia trying to intervene in the election or intervene in the election in 2016, I would have thought that we would be more security-minded about this stuff. But it seems like everybody's more interested in pointing fingers than like, okay, what would a more sophisticated attack, what could that do?
Right.
And so it might not be interesting, but just I am still pretty alarmed by it.
Right. Yeah, there's a kind of there's a kind of paradox, which is the more sophisticated our technology becomes, the greater the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses also multiply exponentially, because you're adding new components to the system all the time. And in cybersecurity, they would say the attack surface keeps getting bigger. The number of places where you could penetrate or attack a society keeps growing more and more. When it comes to things like protecting against an EMP pulse, I suspect the government's worried about that, and they might just be doing things that they're not telling us very openly about. But there do seem to be lots of places where society is still relatively vulnerable. There's an adage, I don't know if this is credited to someone, but there's an adage that society is always about two meals away from collapse. When you think about just-in-time deliveries, and you think about the reduction of inventory and how there probably aren't that many meals stockpiled right now in America. There are lots of reasons to think that our society is pretty fragile. The UN, I think, warned us that we've got about 80 good harvests left before most of the topsoil in the world is worthless. And, you know, what's the response to that? I don't know. I suspect a lot of people respond and say, well, most of us will be dead by then. Or they'll say, well, you know, fertilizers and hydroponics will probably catch up to that problem in the next 80 years. 80 years is a long time, right? Look at farming 80 years ago versus today. And so, again, people, when I worry about techno-optimism, I worry that it becomes a license to ignore serious problems like that.
Right, right. Yeah, well, at least with regard to like the EMP attack and stuff, Ted Koppel has a book, I believe it's Ted Koppel, called Lights Out, that is concerned with what would happen in the United States if there were a massive failure of our electronic technology. And he was able to find no evidence that the government is anywhere concerned with this. Even Jay Johnson, the former head of the Department of Homeland Security under Barack Obama, had this like just breezy, insouciant attitude about this. He was saying things like, oh yeah, there's probably a plan for that. It's probably like one of those folders up there. Like, and Koppel was like, well, let's look at it. He's like, hey, not important. It's just like, so if the government is secretly competent, they're hiding it very well.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very competent, but they're also very competent at appearing incompetent.
Yes.
I remember the blackout in New England. I don't remember when that was. I want to say there was one in the early 2010s, like 2013 or something like that. There was a blackout in the Northeast that knocked out power to tens of millions of people on the Eastern Seaboard in parts of New England and Canada. And it was started because a tree branch fell on a wire somewhere. And it just cascaded in just the right way between all the various substations and so on that all the automatic shutoffs and redundancies were unable to cope with it. And now you have power knocked out to like 20 or 30 million people for a couple hours. So those are certainly opportunities for wake-up calls. It's not really clear how good of a job we've done as a society of hardening ourselves against things like that in the future.
Yeah, I think if something like that did happen, like a massive prolonged power outage in which people starved or there was a complete breakdown of civil society, I think it would go down in the history books as, why didn't these idiots see it coming? Like, yeah, did we not have enough warnings for this?
Right.
So that's one thing to worry about.
There was a great article, just real quick, there was a great article in Wired maybe a year ago about a cyber attack on Maersk. I don't know if you saw that. But it was, they got hit with, I don't know if it was ransomware or just some sort of, no, it was just a worm that just ended up deleting all their hard drives. And Maersk, the world's first or second or third largest shipping company, was basically brought to a standstill. And you have all these stories of container ships sitting in port, unable to unload because they don't actually know what's on each of the containers. And they have to go back to pencil and paper, and Maersk basically gave their IT department a blank check, and it ended up costing something like $800 million to fix. And there are stories of renting just conference rooms in hotels and having their IT people manually copy over the contents of all of their like thousands of laptops that they bought off the shelf to duplicate all of their records. And you think they were able to do that because they found like one set of backups of their central database that was in Nairobi or somewhere remote from their systems in Europe. And they were able to copy that over, And you think how deeply connected, interconnected all these systems were, and how fragile they all are, that they could all be brought offline in a matter of hours or minutes. There's stories in the opening paragraphs of that article about the people in IT just running down the hallways of the Maersk headquarters, screaming into conference rooms to everyone to turn off their laptops because they couldn't stop the worm from propagating. So people are just yanking power cords out of the walls, trying to insulate the computers against the worm, and they couldn't stop.
Oh my God.
It's an amazing, gripping story.
Wow. I'll have to look into that. Mm-hmm. One other thing that we touched on earlier, it's worth saying something about, is totalitarian states and how they can become more powerful with increased technology. I mean, certainly we can look back and see that this was the case. I mean, the Nazis might have done some horrible things, but it's unlikely they could have caused the kind of damage they did without like a modern industrial state and, you know, gas chambers and that sort of thing. But also just, so there's technology that can be used for oppressing, killing quite directly. And there are also surveillance technologies and other technologies, perhaps, that might make totalitarian governments more frightening than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely true. And we're, some people will tell you that we're hurtling towards this sort of total information awareness situation where states or powerful actors that could even be non-states have the resources and the expertise to keep tabs on most people or all people all the time. And they can assemble. I saw a conspiracy theory recently about this that suggested that Facebook was basically a Department of Defense program. It's a resurrected Department of Defense program that was an attempt to build a database that basically tracked everyone's whereabouts and beliefs and associations. And I guess one piece of evidence for this is that the DoD program, which is public, that we know about, and we know the government's aspirations for this, the program was canceled like the day before Facebook launched or something like that. And you know, people connect the dots and they say, oh, Mark Zuckerberg is like the cousin of some DoD official, you know, yada, yada, whatever.
Of course, it wouldn't need to originate with them for them to take a hold of all this information eventually.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, you know, what do we do in a world like that? And I don't know, but I find solace in thinking that my life is relatively uninteresting to the people that have the power to surveil anyone's whereabouts and anyone's activities. I just think, well, in America, they've got 330 million other people, and I'm probably relatively uninteresting if you had your pick of anyone in America to surveil. And that's cold comfort, and I wish that there were more to be done about it, but that's one thing that I've been thinking at least lately.
Yeah, so one other worry I wanted to raise, and I haven't seen this raised before, but I have had the thought recently that the sorts of arguments against trying utopian sort of ways of organizing a state out, a lot of those arguments seem to be undermined by rapidly increasing technology. So, for example, one of them is that, well, look, we can't try central planning. We can't have a government that centrally plans the economy. Why? Well, because information is diffuse, right? This is I believe, Hayek's and von Mises' argument against central planning. Like, there's nobody who has enough knowledge to do it. Well, that's something that could change if you have big data and, you know, enough of these little eyes in the panopticon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we might actually have enough information that somebody might try that again. Another kind of argument again is, well, human nature prevents us from implementing certain sorts of plans, like communism perhaps might make too many demands on human altruism. That's one thing that's been said. But the thing is if human nature itself can be hacked because we have access to the human genome and CRISPR and all of these other technologies, then all of the sort of limiting principles we can put forward on, like, don't try to have this kind of authoritarian state, seems like there's an argument to be made that, oh, well, it's really different this time.
Right, right. Yeah, a lot of the arguments that people would give against them, it sounds like the arguments you're pointing to specifically are arguments that totalitarianism is impractical or unworkable. Not that it's immoral, which would be a separate set of arguments, but the idea that it's impractical, those arguments start to wither away as technology gives us the practical means to bring those things about. And I think that that's right. There's, you know, and even to take it one step further, there's been a history of people, especially in the internet age, saying, heralding the advance of the internet, and because it was supposed to guarantee democracy, it was supposed to democratize information. Information wants to be free.
Yeah, that's not aging well, is it?
No, it has not aged very well. And what we find instead is that the people who were a little bit more balanced at the time, people like Langdon Winner, were right that new technological inventions are often going to play to the benefits of the people who are already most powerful and best entrenched. Who is it that has the power and the resources and the expertise to take advantage of new technological changes? Well, it's probably the people who are presently most powerful and wealthy and entrenched. And so what we often find is technological innovations, even ones like the internet that are supposed to lead to greater liberty, often we find ourselves in much as the similar situation as we always were. That's why we find that even today in the internet age, we're frustrated by the major players who are telecom companies who are basically the progeny of the people that we were frustrated at 50 years ago, and little has changed.
I find it astonishing with the internet in particular, because I've witnessed this, how little we're able to see around the next corner. I remember when I was studying Arabic and preparing to go to Egypt, it was in the aftermath, or maybe in the middle of, depending on how you define it, of the so-called Arab Spring. And people were talking like, oh, you know, all of these countries that have been authoritarian forever, it's all going to change now because we've got Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
this is the insanely optimistic things that were said. And now people are seriously wondering whether those technologies are threatening democracy where it's been established for a long time.
Right, yeah. The opposite has become true, yeah.
Right, and not a very big period of time, views have just completely flipped. Mm-hmm. That's just like in less than a decade.
Right, right.
So I'm wondering if you have anything else to add. We're nearing the end of our time here.
Well, I think that we've done a good job of casing the legitimate grounds that we have to be worried about technological advance. And I want to reiterate something that both of us were careful to say explicitly, which is that it's probably true that technological advance, by and large, is almost certainly true, has been a net positive for humanity. But the picture is complicated. And the more we can do to pay attention to those complications and the places where the advance is not an unalloyed benefit, I think that we'll do a better job of anticipating the harms that would otherwise be unforeseen. And I think that that's the task of people nowadays, and especially of this current generation and the next generation of technologists.
Right. Well, I'm already thinking of new things we didn't touch on. So technology is probably a net positive for humanity. What about animals? Probably not, when we look at all the animals in factory farms. And for the environment, I think that's a big question mark too. But it just shows what a big topic this is, and we'll have to continue this conversation some other time. So, thanks, Ryan, for joining me today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.